Good morning, Nexus. Oh, I'm tuckered out this morning. Friends, there are times when you make a mistake and those have consequences. And this week, I fear I made one of those. You see, for years now, my kids, particularly Zoe, every single day asking for a dog. And I've been a strong tower buffering these attacks against me. No. But I opened the door a crack this week. And next thing I know, well, we have a dog. This is Lloyd. It's a she. We're all confused here about names. I don't know what's going on. But this dog has been... it's been a trying week, friends. Let's just say that. I'm not sure. I forgot. Puppies are a lot to handle, but this is Lloyd, and things are getting weird in the Watson household. I digress. Listen, friends, I want to spend this Sunday and next Sunday looking at a series of questions that I hope will prove insightful for us, locating us where we are in time and space. You see, back in 2007, the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor penned the book The Secular Age. And for academics and thinkers, this book has become huge. It's almost become like a cult-like status around this book. In fact, it's been said of the book that it is the first book, perhaps, written in the 21st century that many believe will be read and studied late in the 22nd century. And so this book has been very influential. And every good Christian thinker, I believe, at least any worth their salt, has been interacting with Charles Taylor's thought over the last number of years. And if you've seen books or read books in the past few years about doubt and deconstruction, chances are the authors are in some way pulling on Charles Taylor's thoughts. And there's been a whole field of books about his work, and in particular, the two Christian thinkers, James K.A. Smith and Andrew Root, have been doing a lot of work on the implications of what this book reveals to us about our time and age. And so I wanted to spend this week and next poking around with some of Charles Taylor's thoughts. And in particular, I want to piggyback on James K. Smith and Andy Root. Together, they've written 5 books in total about this. And you'd be doing well for yourself to get your hand on any number of these books. But we've got How Not to Be Secular and On the Road with St. Augustine by James K. Smith, and Faith Formation in a Secular Age, The Pastor in a Secular Age, and The Congregation in a Secular Age by Andrew Root. And all of these books are dynamite. I can't recommend them highly enough. But here's the deal for this morning. You see, this is going to be part 1 of 2. And so you're going to be left with a bit of a cliffhanger at the end of the morning. At the end of this teaching, I think you're going to be like, okay, that was interesting, but I'm not sure where this leaves us. Hang with me. Next week, we're going to get more into the implications. But I want to begin this morning by asking a series of questions, and they are these. First, why is it so hard to be a person of faith today? Second, why does it feel as though depression and anxiety are at an all-time high? Third, why are doubt and deconstruction so popular these days? And fourth, why do we pastors have no clue what we're doing? Now, the short answer to all of these questions is quite simply the secular. But the trouble for many of us is that we don't really have a good grasp on the secular. For many of us, I think we probably grew up in environments where the secular sort of seemed obvious, but it doesn't really get at the root of things, you could say. I remember when I was in high school, and you know, I grew up in an environment where we weren't allowed to listen to secular music. And I remember in particular my parents coming into my room this particular day, and I was listening to music, doing my teenage thing. And remember, they were looking through my CDs, and they came across Aerosmith's 1993 album, Get a Grip. And its cover of course, as you can see, is a cow udder with a piercing. And this sent my parents into a conniption. They thought this was some sort of devil imagery. They were not happy about this. And they gave me the rundown, the lowdown, that we do not listen to secular music. And you see, for many of us, I think what we were taught or what we thought we knew about secularism is that it was simply that which is not Christian. And so for many of us, I think the thought was there's, you know, secular music, then there's Christian music, there's Christian art and there's secular art, there's Christian movies and secular movies, you know, Christian books, secular books. And so secular sort of became this idea. It was a stand-in for anything that wasn't Christian, which is a bit of an impoverished idea. So I want to unpack what we mean by secular. And to do that, I want to move back in time, say 500 years or more, into a world that we'll call secular world zero. There's no such thing as secular in this age. This is a world before or without the secular. And in this world, people, you could say, had a sense of what was sacred, and the way that people talked and moved through life and through the world, it spoke of a world that was haunted, you could say, by transcendence. And up to 500 years ago, faith formation wasn't even really a thing that people thought of, because every interaction and every aspect of culture perpetuated belief. Society at large contributed to faith formation. I mean, consider this statue for a moment. It's a statue of Paolo Sarpi in Venice. And Sarpi was a friend, of course, of the famous Galileo. They lived in the 16th century. And this statue is interesting to me because the inscription below it says this of Sarpi, the only unbeliever of his generation. I mean, we're talking about a very different world, a very different age here. Only one unbeliever in the whole generation. I mean, this is incredible when you think about it. It was such an oddity for someone to be an unbeliever. You get a statue and an inscription on it. And this is the world we're talking about with secular world zero. There's no such thing as the secular. Everything about culture, society perpetuates belief. And you could say that the secular world zero was shaped by three things, at least three things. The first is this enchantment. You see, in the secular world zero, the Middle Ages we're talking about here, it was a time of enchantment. People believed in God, in angels, in demons, in fairies, in witches, sacred places. Each of these types of things had this mysterious sort of real effect on individuals and society. The world was haunted, you could say, by powers of both good and evil. I mean, consider this very real church crisis that happened in the 16th century. This was a big deal at the time that needed a solution. You see, what was happening is this. As people were coming to Mass at the church, they were taking the host, the bread, you could say, but they weren't swallowing it. And this was a big problem because they believed that this bread had this real enchanting power and effect. It was Jesus' actual body. And so what was happening is people were going to church, taking it or not swallowing it, and then they were sneaking it home, and they would, you know, plant it, say, in their fields so that, you know, their crops would have extra power. It would benefit their crops, or they'd feed it to their sick cow or their goat or whatever, because they thought that this thing had power, healing power. And so these people, of course, had this deep sense that the world was a magical place. And so the solution to the problem that became church law was that you, of course, had to open your mouth and the priest would put the host on your tongue and you'd have to show that you swallowed it. I mean, this is the crisis in church in the 16th century. And it wasn't just that they thought that this was a powerful good thing. It was a terrifying thing for people. It was a magical thing. And if you ingested the holy into the body of a sinner, well, you could be bringing some serious judgment on yourself. In fact, it became so frightening for people to take the Eucharist that they had to make a church law. At bare minimum, you had to take it twice a year. And guess how many times most people took it? Twice a year, the bare minimum, because this was a frightening act. It was a moment where a sinner came in contact with the holy, and that could destroy you. I mean, consider how we think of the Eucharist today. I mean, it's just a very different social imagination. Chances are, as we come forward to take it, we're thinking something like, well, is that gluten-free bread? You know, what's in that? Or is that grape juice? I hope they didn't use grape juice. Or what wine? Did they get the cheap wine, right? Like, we're not sort of thinking, oh my goodness, this is about to have some sort of magical power on me. Our minds are more preoccupied with ingredients than anything. And what we'll learn, I think, about secular world zero, about the aspects of this culture, is that while we have left this world behind, right, we certainly don't live in that kind of world, but it doesn't mean that we don't at times feel this or even crave it in certain ways. I mean, consider that just a few weeks ago, the city of Kitchener hosted for free what they called an enchanted forest in Bright Up Park. And this thing sold out quickly. All you had to do was grab the tickets. They were free, but it sold out quickly. And it was amazing to me how many people in Kitchener wanted to go into this enchanted forest. My family and I were able to go, and it was just a fascinating sort of display, because really the enchanted forest, it was beautiful, it was lovely, but you walk through a forest at night and they had set up, you know, lights and TVs and, you know, all these different sort of tech LED light displays, and that's what made the forest enchanted. And like I said, it was beautiful, but what it tells me is that there's a craving in humanity, even now, even still, for that feeling of enchantment. But unlike our ancestors just 500 years ago, for us, enchantment means bringing technology into a forest and lighting it up at night. But think of how someone 500 years ago would have thought about walking through an enchanted forest. It would have been terrifying. What are you going to encounter? A demon? A witch? A fairy? I mean, something like that. They believed in enchantment for sure, but it wasn't sort of an entertainment thing. The whole world was haunted by the transcendence, and it was both beautiful and frightening. The second thing about a secular world zero is things. You see, in this sort of world where there's no idea of the secular, things themselves are fused with meaning. And you can play this, you can see this play out in a number of ways in a secular world zero. If you've done any reading in the Celtic tradition, you will know that they have this propensity to bless everything. There's blessings for every sort of occasion, every material object. Just bless everything, because the alternative was, well, perhaps a little scary. And so when you read through Celtic stuff, you know, there could be a blessing for your kitchen table, your bed, your front door. Everything needed to be blessed. And there's this sense that it keeps sort of the haunted spirits away. You also see this in the Middle Age, in the Catholic Church. Faith formation was, in many ways, we've totally lost this today, but in many ways, it was about getting people close to relics, right? Relics, these ancient faith things, they had power, you could say. For instance, there's a bit of a legend, of course, around Jesus' crown of thorns. You'll know from the crucifixion story that the soldiers put a mock crown of thorns on Jesus' head. And, you know, as legend has it, this was kept within the church, and it was kept in Jerusalem, in fact, until I think it is 1063, I think it was, when it was moved to Constantinople. But in 1238, the French king, Louis IX, travels to Constantinople, takes the crown of thorns, brings it back to Paris, and what he does is he builds Sainte-Chapelle to house this relic. And eventually, Notre Dame is the place where the crown of thorns is held. And many of the medieval churches that we know and that boast this incredible architecture and beauty, we look back on them as just magnificent bodies of work, just incredible engineering, and yet they were built oftentimes to house relics. And the idea, of course, with housing relics is that if people simply got close to them, they could have healing or inspiring effects on people. It was get close to the relics and you're close to something that has magical power. And of course, again, right, we don't live in this world. We've largely left that world behind, yet we still have echoes of this past with us today. I mean, this is true, I would say, especially in sports. An example even closer to home, I mean, how many of us remember the famous Jose Bautista bat flip? I mean, for Toronto Blue Jay fans, this was such a huge sporting moment, right? And, you know, I was doing some research this week and I realized the ball that Jose Bautista hit that home run on. It was put up for auction, I think back in 2019, and it sold for $28,000. I mean, we're talking about a baseball here, and yet there's still a notion inside of us that some things are more important, more special than others. It's just a baseball, but it's the baseball, the Jose Bautista bat flip baseball. Finally, this secular world zero is also marked by this idea that we are self-porous creatures as opposed to buffered. Now, I'm not sure that probably makes sense right off the bat, but self-porous means that as humans, we can actually take things in. And two quick historical stories I'll tell you about this to illustrate the point. Back when Queen Victoria was Queen of England, she was pregnant, and she was told that she should not visit the zoo while pregnant. And why? Well, the thinking was this: if she ran into or saw, say, an elephant, it might mean that her child would be born with big ears. This is a real thing. This is real advice given to the Queen of England. And why? Because the idea, even just 200 years ago, was that we are self-porous creatures. Things can get into us. In fact, it was beyond just the queen. Pregnant women in general were told and advised to avoid seeing drunken people on the street. And why? Because it might mean that your baby becomes a drunkard. Or think back 1,000 years. This is such a funny little silly story to me, but Saint Augustine, right? When he was a child, he came down with some sort of flu-like symptoms. And so what his mother did to help him was stripped him naked, soaked him in water, and then rolled him in salt. And why? The idea was that the salt would protect him from demons getting inside of him. And you know, today, of course, none of us are anxious about demons getting into us. I mean, even consider little things like when our children sort of act out, right? Like our thinking is not, oh my goodness, there's some sort of spiritual attack happening here. It's usually, oh, they've been overstimulated, or, you know, maybe they're hangry, or they haven't had enough sleep. Our inclination today in our time is to immediately think of natural and material causes. We're less prone to think that there might be some sort of spiritual transcendent powers at work. You see, in a secular world, zero faith formation was easy. Everything perpetuated it. A pastor or priest job was easy as well. I mean, you were simply sort of navigating, mediating between the divine and humans. You didn't have to think about faith formation. It just was everywhere. And of course, you've probably heard me and others talk about us re-enchanting our faith. And it's important to know that when people today talk about re-enchanting our faith, what we're not talking about is going back to secular world zero, right? I think when thinking about that, all of us can agree that would be not a good thing. Nobody wants to return there. Though the idea, I think, more is this: our current age, though clearly preferable than secular world zero, it's still a kind of world, it's a construct of a world, you could say, that has its own problems and blind spots. And those blind spots, you could say, make faith formation incredibly difficult. But to understand the secular age that we live in today, we have to track its progress, the way it's snowballed over the past 100 or so years. Now, of course, there are all sorts of reasons why we moved into a secular age. Things like the Protestant Reformation, the Enlightenment, dawn of modernity, science, technology, all of these things are playing into that. But that's not my focus necessarily on the causes, but to sort of just nail down for us, what does it mean for us to live in a secular age? And in the very first sort of age of the secular arrives with what we would call secular world one. And this sort of came at the turn of the 20th century and lasted probably around to the Vietnam War. There's some stuff around the 60s, I think, that pushed us even deeper into a secular age. But what you could say is this: the secular age first began with something that I think many of us take for granted, and it's that public life and private life became divided and divorced. I mean, consider for a moment the four things you're not supposed to talk about at a dinner party, right? Politics, religion, money, and sex. And why is that? Because we have come to think as people that those are private things. And even though we talk relentlessly about politics today, there's still an aspect of that going on. I mean, just this last election, I remember I was in a conversation with somebody talking politics, different people's policies. And then I asked them, so who are you voting for? And there was this like awkward moment, like, whoa, okay, it's okay to talk about politics, but to ask someone straight up, who are you voting for? There's a bit of this like, whoa. We've moved from public discussion into something that's very private. It's the same, you could say, with religion. Of course, we can talk about religion because we're part of a faith community, but it's like once you get outside a faith community and you're with parents at the park or you're chatting with people at the hockey rink or at some sort of social event, it's like that gets awkward and weird, and we sort of don't mind somebody saying, hey, I'm an atheist, or, you know, I'm a Hindu, or I'm a Christian, but rarely do we want to sort of get much deeper than that because religion and faith have come to be seen as a private thing. Now, of course, those two sort of straddle the line, but if there's two things that we'll never talk about, it is money and sex. I mean, here's the reality. I like to think there's not a whole lot of taboos at Nexus, but the reality is there's probably at least two questions I'll never ask you. The first around money. Chances are I'm never going to come up to you and say, hey, how much money do you have in your bank account right now? Or, hey, what is your salary? What do you make a year? For some reason for us, that is a very private thing, and we don't cross that boundary. There's public discourse, and then there's private things we don't touch or consider sex, right? Like, chances are I'm not going to come up to you and say something like, hey, how often do you have sex? What positions do you like? Do you have any weird sexual fetishes? I mean, that is off limits, right? Those sorts of things are seen as very private. And so in secular world one, the world begins to divide up between those things that are public and those things that are private. And this creates a particular problem for churches and faith formation, because if faith is private, then how do you keep people coming to church, and how do you keep people going with their faith formation if now faith is a private thing? What happens is the church's strategy in general, right? I'm speaking in broad terms here, but in general is to appeal to people's duty and will. So yes, you might not be scared of hell or demons or, you know, being haunted by mysterious spirits. In this world, faith is private, but what we can still appeal to, the church sort of says, is your duty. You have a duty to the institution of church. You have a duty to show up. You must will yourself to continue along in faith formation and in the church community. Now, post the 60s, we kind of move into what Charles Taylor identifies as sort of a secular world too. The secular age is snowballing and picking up speed here, because in the 60s, we have social revolution, right? And people begin to lose trust in institutions. People lose trust in the government because they're sending people off to unjust wars in Vietnam. They're losing trust in the church because the church has a whole lot of skeletons in its closet. And so as people lose trust in tradition, and institutions, the secular age picks up speed and momentum, and it's mostly characterized, secular world too, as a religious or a religious world, right? The church is in crisis. Fewer and fewer people are coming to church, and faith formation is now very difficult. And what is a pastor supposed to do when we live in a world where just fewer and fewer people are coming to church? Secular world too is simply framed by religious and a religious. There's a battle, you could say, going on. How do we get people to come to church? And the temptation for churches ever since the 60s, right up till probably, well, even now in some regards, but right up until sort of maybe early 2000s, 2010, there's kind of a marking line, a difference there. But the temptation became for churches to use more resources to gain people's commitment and loyalty. And so in this age, we see the rise of the apologetic movement, right? If what we need is more resources, then what we need to do is resource people with the best, most sound arguments, the most convincing arguments there are for being a Christian. And so apologetics get our best minds working on this. And so there's that. And then you also see the rise of the mega church, right? So for busy families, what we want the church to provide is virtually every resource that a family could want or desire. You want a great kids program? We've got it. You have a problem in your marriage? We've got marriage counseling. You got an addiction? We got addiction stuff going on. You're looking for sports and leisure? We've got that going on. What the church essentially does is try to sell this idea that we have all the resources in the world. And you know, the sermon also becomes something, right? In this age, it's no longer just enough to open the Bible and preach it. It's like there has to be some communication expertise. You've got to be able to sort of entertain and have certain charisma in front of crowds. And it's also in this day and age that the youth group becomes huge, right? And the idea is this: if we don't get our youth, if we don't resource them, they'll be gone and then the church will be finished. And so you see a huge movement to really resource youth groups. I mean, and this is still going on in a lot of ways. The church I was at before, I remember in the span of 3 years, we renoed and redid the youth room 4 different times. And the idea was we have to keep upping the game. More resources. We've got to have ping pong tables and video games and super soft couches and beanbag chairs and cool lighting, right? Like the idea is, if the issue is just less people coming to church, we counter that by resources, more money spent trying to get people to come to church. And this idea of resources is definitely a challenge. It's one solution to the problem, right? This idea that, okay, so in a secular world, the issue is that just people aren't coming to church as much. So more resources on apologetics and churches and more of this, better programming, all of that stuff. But what we have seen over the past 50 years is despite all the resourcing, the church continues to shrink. Fewer and fewer people are going to church. And what Taylor and others say is that it's not for lack of trying, it's not for lack of resources. There's a deeper heart to secularism that we need to understand before we can sort of address the problem and symptoms. And what secular world three is that we've moved into, or that is the heart of secularism, is simply this: the contesting and fragilizing of all belief. And I think this starts to get at the heart of the questions that I asked first thing this morning, the contesting and fragilizing of all belief. And what that simply means is this: all of us, people of faith, are haunted by certain questions. Questions like this: would it really matter if I believed what the atheist does or the Hindu does? Can I know my beliefs are better or more true? Would it really make a difference? I mean, maybe they're right and I'm wrong. Or we're haunted by questions like these, particularly for those of us who grew up in the church. It's like, do I really believe this, or am I just a product of the home that I grew up in? How do I know I actually believe this? Is this just something I've been socialized into? All belief starts to sort of feel soft and fragile and contested. And yet the thing is this, and this is interesting, what Taylor points out is that this actually works both ways. Even those who do not believe have their unbelief fragilized and contested. I mean, for the person who's like, I know religion isn't true. I know it. I know there's no such thing as God, but there are moments when that becomes fragile and contested. That time you first told your child, or the time you lost your mother. And in those moments, right, there's a doubt, you could say, this possibility that maybe there's something more. And it doesn't even have to be those big moments. It can be hearing that song at Christmas time that makes you feel magical or nostalgic, and you can't help but wonder, maybe there's something more. Maybe it's at a concert. I think the Vinyl Cafe used to do this for a lot of people, right? Like just this sense, even for those who don't believe, maybe my belief in unbelief is fragile as well. And what Taylor and others go on to note is that every believer finds themselves in doubt, but at some point, every doubter finds themselves a believer. There's only a small percentage of people who never doubt themselves. In believing circles, it's fundamentalists. In atheist circles, it's the British new atheists, you could say. It's only fundamentalists who don't ever doubt. For the rest of us, doubt is a constant friend and companion because we live in an age where beliefs are contested and fragile. And what we have to understand is that the secular age three, it's a construct. It's not simply that we've arrived here because this is the world we've constructed and live in is true. No, we live just as people here did in a secular world zero. They lived under a certain construct. Our world is also a construct, and it makes belief and faith formation incredibly difficult. Charles Taylor calls us living in the imminent frame. He says this: "The imminent frame is a constructed social space that frames our lives entirely within a natural rather than supernatural order. It is the circumscribed space of the modern social imaginary that precludes transcendence." We all inherit a cultural frame, you could say, and our cultural frame is to expect that there is nothing of transcendence. And what Taylor goes on to note is we have to understand this is as much of a social construct as anything else. And so we are expected not to see anything of transcendence in our world. And yet this secular world three is also an age where all belief, believer and unbeliever, any sort of belief feels fragile and contested. And I think you could say this about secular age three: it carries with it both promise, potential, but also pitfalls. And next Sunday, I want to dive deeply into that. What does it mean to live in the modern malaise, secular world three, where all belief is contested, all belief is fragile, and the haunting transcendence of God feels completely absent and gone? That's where I want to head to next week, but I want to close this morning with the words of Galadriel from Lord of the Rings. It opens up the Lord of the Rings with her melancholy whisper, and she says this: "The world is changed. I feel it in the water. I feel it in the earth. I smell it in the air. Much that once was is lost, for none now live who remember it." The world has changed. We find ourselves in a very peculiar, unique phase of human history, different, far different than anything most of human history has encountered. And it has both promise, potential, and pitfalls. That I want to get to next week. Thanks for joining us this morning, Nexus. I know that was a lot to absorb and, you know, sort of a lot of information there, but I hope you were able to track with me. And next week, I want to focus in on what this all means for us as we try to do faith formation, try to be a church community in the secular age. For now, for this week, go in peace.